From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. A mass kidnapping of Christians by the Islamic State. EU ministers approve Greek bailout extension. President Obama rejects controversial pipeline bill. Rock-eating and breathing organisms change the meaning of life. These and other stories coming up. I'm Ray Kugel. Islamic State militants have kidnapped at least 90 Assyrian Christians during raids in northeastern Syria. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says scores of local residents were abducted after clashes in the Kabur area of Hasaka province. Islamic State fighters have routinely targeted religious and ethnic minorities, using kidnappings and killings in their quest for territorial expansion across Syria and Iraq. Faced with increased threats of kidnap and death from Islamic State militants, Syria is becoming a no-go zone for expatriate aid workers, despite the desperation of civilians there. Sharon Bain reports on the ever-higher cost of trying to help those in need and the populations left behind.
Aid workers in war zones such as Syria face a relentless cycle of violence and personal risk, says the co-founder of International NGO Safety and Security Association, Amari Cooper.
It's kidnapping, it's direct targeting, bombing, it's threats that are collateral threats that could be sort of just wrong place at the wrong time, where an IED, it happens to be on the road where there's an IED that goes off. And then they could be direct sort of being used as political pawns, where they're being kidnapped to make a message or kidnapped for ransom.
10 years ago, aid and humanitarian workers largely were seen as separate from the conflicts in which they were trying to operate. Even now, in some conflict countries, aid workers are able to negotiate their presence. But Vice President Joel Charney of InterAction, an alliance of U.S.-based relief and development agencies, says in areas controlled by extremist groups like Islamic State, things have changed.
I think in those particular places, the NGO label or the humanitarian label carries with it, you know, very little protection, and indeed our community can be seen as a soft target.
American aid worker Kayla Mueller died in 2015 while being held hostage in Syria by Islamic State militants. Just months before, the same group beheaded British aid worker David Haynes, also kidnapped in Syria. According to Humanitarian Outcomes, violent acts against aid workers around the world have increased in the past decade, with kidnapping seeing the steepest rise. In 2012, Afghanistan, Pakistan, South Sudan, and Somalia ranked as the most violent. The vice president of risk management company Unity Resources Group, Jim LeBlanc, says as a result, most aid organizations are reevaluating their security plans.
A lot of these organizations have become much more sophisticated in how they do their duty of care obligations, which is what reasonable steps are they obligated to mitigate the risk of something bad happening to one of their staff. And that duty of care obligation doesn't just pertain to, for example, expats or internationals, but it also goes to how do you take reasonable steps to protect your local staff.
When danger levels are considered too severe, expatriate staff are often evacuated, leaving local staff to continue the aid work. Sharon Bain, VOA News, Washington.
Countries of Southeast Europe have pledged to intensify cooperation in the fight against terrorism in the region, Europe, and the world. Meeting in Tirana, Albania Tuesday, foreign ministers of 13 countries making up the Southeast European cooperation process issued a 10-point statement condemning the phenomenon of foreign terrorist fighters and terrorist cells in Europe and beyond. The European Union's foreign policy chief says a deal on Iran's nuclear program is at hand, and she is optimistic it will be finalized before the March 24th deadline. Federica Mogherini spoke at the Chatham House Research Organization in London. VOA's Alpesin has more.
Mogherini said she's an Iran deal optimist, and there is a historic opportunity to reach a deal in the coming weeks.
A good deal is at hand if the parties will keep cooperating as they did so far, and if we'll have enough political will on all sides to agree on a good deal and sell it domestically.
European Union officials have been convening intensive talks in recent weeks among officials of Iran and the six nations designated by the United Nations to hold the talks. That has included several meetings between Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif and U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, who have cited unspecified progress. But Secretary Kerry told members of Congress Tuesday,
"We've halted the progress of Tehran's nuclear program. We've gained unprecedented insight into it. And we expect to know soon whether or not Iran is willing to put together an acceptable and verifiable plan."
Negotiators have missed two previous deadlines, and officials say it will be difficult to convince skeptics on both sides to accept another extension. The talks are aimed at providing guarantees that Iran will not build a nuclear weapon and ending international sanctions against it. Al Pessin, VOA News, London.
Foreign ministers from France, Germany, Russia, and Ukraine are demanding that all sides respect the shaky ceasefire in Ukraine, although Moscow, Kiev, and separatists in eastern Ukraine dispute many of the details. The ministers met Tuesday in Paris, where Lisa Bryant picks up the story.
The four-way meeting in Paris produced a joint statement, read out by French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius.
Nous quatre nous appelons à la mise en œuvre stricte de toutes les dispositions des accords de Minsk.
Fabius said the four ministers from France, Germany, Russia, and Ukraine called for the strict application of all agreements that were reached in previous negotiations in Minsk, starting with a ceasefire and a complete withdrawal of heavy weapons. A declaration released by the French Foreign Ministry also called for reinforcement of a mission by the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe and a guarantee of full access to all Ukrainian conflict zones so the OSCE monitors can inspect the ceasefire firsthand. Under the peace deal reached earlier this month in the Belarusian capital, both Ukrainian troops and Russian-supported rebel forces are supposed to withdraw their heavy weapons, pulling them back between 25 and 70 kilometers to create a buffer zone in eastern Ukraine. Rebels said Tuesday they have begun to move their heavy weapons away from the front lines, but Ukrainian authorities dispute that claim. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
A Russian newspaper published what it says is a strategy document calling for Russia to annex Crimea and parts of eastern Ukraine that was presented to the Kremlin in early February 2014, shortly before Ukraine's pro-Russian President Viktor Yanukovych was forced out of power. Mr. Yanukovych fled Kiev and subsequently went to Russia. Eurozone finance ministers have approved a Greek proposal aimed at reducing economic hardships in the country. The move could lead to Athens receiving a pivotal bailout extension before the weekend. Sheila Hennessy has details.
Eurogroup President Yorin Dijsselbloem said on Tuesday that Greece's reform proposal demonstrated an unequivocal commitment to honor its financial obligations.
So I think they are serious, but it's not going to be easy. This is just a first step, and it's going to take time to really get into the details and to design a new contract or agreement which will carry us on for 4 months.
On Tuesday, the finance ministers approved the proposal, which will now be put forward to national governments for agreement before Saturday, when Athens' nearly $300 billion bailout program is due to expire. If Greece fails to win the extension, it could face insolvency and risk having to leave the single currency union. On Tuesday, many Greeks said they felt hopeful. This 70-year-old says he's modestly optimistic that Greece will be able to remain in the eurozone, but the problems cannot be easily solved. This unemployed citizen says this is the first government to negotiate real progress for Greece. She says, however, she's only cautiously optimistic. Greece has been trying to negotiate changes to its loan program since the leftist Syriza party took power in January on a campaign pledge to end Greece's stringent bailout terms. Germany and other European countries have demanded that Athens live up to its original commitments. In its new reform proposal submitted on Monday, Athens pledged to take a disciplined approach to budgets, spending and tax collection. The government said it aims to ease Greece's humanitarian crisis, which has been caused by years of economic hardship and high unemployment, but that this will not impact the government's budget. Zayla Hennessy for VOA News, London.
A gunman opened fire at a restaurant in the Czech Republic, killing eight people before turning the gun on himself Tuesday. Czech Public Radio reports the perpetrator called a local television station before the attack, complaining that police were not solving his problems and threatening that he would take things into his own hands. The Czech Interior Minister says it was not a terrorist attack.
VOA podcasts are a convenient way to get your information on the run.
VOANews.com.
Visit VOANews.com and click on podcasts to learn how you can subscribe.
A suicide bombing killed at least 10 people in the Nigerian city of Kano. The bombing occurred Tuesday at the Kano Line bus station. Earlier, at least 17 people died and dozens more were wounded by an explosion aboard a bus in Potiskum. Authorities say it was not clear whether the suspected bomber was wearing the explosives or had them hidden in luggage. There are no claims of responsibility. The UN Refugee Agency reports thousands of people are fleeing an upsurge of violence between Muslim ex-Seleka and Christian anti-Balaka militias in Central African Republic. Lisa Schlein has more from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UNHCR says the latest surge of violence in the Central African Republic is linked with seasonal movements of livestock and was triggered by clashes between herders and farmers on one side and the anti-Balaka on the other. It says some herders have turned to ex-Seleka armed groups for protection. UNHCR spokeswoman Karen de Gruul tells VOA, people caught in the middle of the fighting have no choice but to flee their homes.
There are hardly any local authorities left. There's no police, there's no gendarmerie. So many of the militias, both anti-Balaka and ex-Seleka, have free rein. We also understand that there is fighting among themselves. There is fighting between ex-Seleka and anti-Balaka. And there is just general lawlessness. And the civilian population is being caught in the middle.
Since January, the UNHCR reports an estimated 30,000 people have fled the area, mainly to the towns of Batan Gafo and Bambari. The agency says those who recently arrived in Bambari are destitute and distraught. Gruul says gunmen enter some of the sites for displaced people, threatening them and extorting money. She says the situation in Congo is not much better. The UNHCR has registered more than 19,000 refugees from the CAR since December, many of them children. She says refugees living in makeshift shelters are vulnerable to armed groups who reportedly are infiltrating the country.
Our teams have received alarming reports of sexual violence committed by these armed elements crossing over from Car.
Gruul says UNHCR staff fear many more cases of rape are going unreported. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Ebola is having an effect on North Korea, even though the deadly virus is still only a threat. Pyongyang is implementing stiff travel restrictions. And as VOA's Brian Padden explains, they are motivated by more than just public health concerns.
Even though there have been no reported cases of Ebola in Asia, North Korea closed its borders to foreign tourists last October to prevent the spread of the disease. It also imposed a strict 21-day quarantine for foreign aid workers and diplomats who enter the country. Travel agencies now say that authorities are banning foreigners from participating in the upcoming Pyongyang Marathon, one of its most popular tourist events. Last year was the first time foreign runners were allowed to participate. Tour groups were planning to market the event in conjunction with arts festivals and cultural events surrounding the birthday of North Korea's founder, Kim Il-sung, on April 15th. But it is not just tourism that is being affected. Andre Abrahamian, the director of Chosun Exchange, an organization that provides entrepreneurship and economic training to North Koreans, has lost thousands of dollars in grants and contracts because of the travel restrictions.
They said to us, if you can't guarantee this program will run by the end of March, we need to use it elsewhere. And unfortunately, we haven't been able to make that guarantee. So we have lost some funding.
Abrahamian says under Kim Jong-un, the government has tried to encourage new business and investment ventures despite already strict controls and limited access to the internet and other telecommunications. But the new travel restrictions are setting back these efforts.
So the Ebola thing kind of illustrates the tension between some competing goals at the higher levels of decision making, I think, yeah.
This is not the first time Pyongyang has tightened border controls to avoid disease outbreaks. North Korea closed its borders during the SARS epidemic in 2003, but that disease was prevalent in Asia, especially next door in China. Brian Patton, VOA News, Seoul.
The head of the United Nations panel on climate change, Rajendra Pachauri, has stepped down following allegations of sexual harassment. Pachauri, an Indian citizen, chaired the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change since 2002 and was part of the team that accepted its 2007 Nobel Prize. In a letter sent to UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, Mr. Pachauri said the panel needs strong leadership and dedication of time, which under current circumstances he is unable to provide.
Hi, this is Larry London. Join me for Border Crossings every weekday at 15 hours Universal Time on VOA Music Mix. Border Crossings is where you decide what we play. It's an hour of your requests, great giveaways, and interviews with music superstars. Tune in to Border Crossings Monday through Friday at 15 hours Universal Time on VOA Music Mix.
President Obama vetoed a bill to approve the Keystone XL pipeline, a project that sparked controversy between environmentalists and oil industry supporters in the United States. White House correspondent Luis Ramirez reports.
The Keystone XL pipeline would move as many as 830,000 barrels of oil, largely from Canada, to the Midwestern U.S. state of Nebraska, in what proponents said would be a massive boost to the U.S. oil industry and the nation's energy supply. Environmentalists opposed the plan, but President Obama, in a letter to the Senate Tuesday, cited a procedural matter as the reason for his veto. Shortly before the president issued the veto, White House spokesman Josh Earnest said Congress had passed the bill without waiting for the State Department to conclude a review of the project.
It circumvents a longstanding administrative process for evaluating whether or not infrastructure projects like this are in the best interest of the country. And it does not represent a specific position on the pipeline itself. It just merely says that benefits and consequences of building that pipeline should be thoroughly evaluated by experts.
This is the third veto of Mr. Obama's presidency. It sparked a heated debate between the president and the pipeline's Republican supporters, who accused the U.S. leader of trying to appease environmentalists at the expense of economic growth. The State Department has yet to complete its review that is to determine whether the pipeline would be in the national interest. White House spokesman Earnest indicated there is still a chance the president may approve the project.
It certainly is possible. The president will keep an open mind as the State Department considers the wide range of impacts that this pipeline could have on the country, both positive and negative.
Pipeline proponents led by Republicans in the Senate plan to vote in the coming weeks to try to override the president's veto. However, the bill passed both houses of Congress with vote margins well short of the two-thirds majorities needed to override a veto. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, at the White House.
The U.S. Justice Department will not file civil rights charges against George Zimmerman, the Florida Neighborhood Watch volunteer who fatally shot unarmed African-American teenager Trayvon Martin in 2012. The Justice Department says the evidence did not meet the high standard for a federal hate crime prosecution, but that the decision should not end efforts to explore racial tensions in the justice system. The decision closes the federal investigation. Zimmerman, who is white, shot Martin as the teen walked back to a relative's home after purchasing snacks at a convenience store in Sanford, Florida. Scientists thought they knew a lot about how life works until a discovery more than two decades ago challenged conventional beliefs. Scientists found that there are organisms that breathe rocks. It is only recently that the scientific community is accepting that there are organisms that could get energy out of rocks. New discoveries are still being made, including organisms that also eat rocks. Here's Elizabeth Lee with more.
Kenneth Nielsen can be described in many ways, including expert in microbiology and biochemistry. But that's not the one he is most proud of.
People call me the father of Shewanella.
Shewanella is an unusual bacterium that shocked the scientific community. Nielsen discovered it 25 years ago in a lake. Like other organisms, it breathes oxygen, but it also breathes rock. Nielsen looks at a time-lapse video of the Shewanella breathing rock. It shows a piece of manganese oxide slowly disappearing over several hours.
That particle that you saw disappear before your eyes in 18 hours, under those conditions, should have been stable for thousands of years.
All living things, including people, make energy through what's called electron transfer. It involves taking electrons from the food we eat.
When we breathe in oxygen, we give electrons to it, and it's that voltage that allows us to make energy.
This process usually happens internally. But for the Shewanella and other mineral-breathing organisms, the electron transfer happens outside the cell. When the process was first discovered, it seemed impossible to the scientific community.
This was one of the most exciting times in my career, when you realize that you have something that probably no one else has and that almost no one's going to believe.
Since then, microbiologists have found other organisms that breathe metal. And Nielsen says they are finally making it into science textbooks. Building on Nielsen's work, one researcher in his lab, Annette Rowe, just made another discovery. Bacteria that eat rock in ocean sediments as an energy source and transfer electrons from outside the cell membrane into the cell.
So you don't actually have to internalize it to get energy from it.
It's going to be as wacky as the 15 years ago, 25 years ago. Because you could see from the reviews of this that some people just didn't believe it, okay, and they didn't want to believe it.
These findings have implications that extend to outer space and how life might exist on a planet like Mars. Nielsen says one of his former students is now building this instrument that will attach to the arm of a rover and give scientists a special set of eyes on the 2020 Mars mission.
If you picked up a nice fluorescent signal from a Mars rock or a sediment or a core, if we could drill into it, and all of a sudden you saw certain colors of fluorescence, you would say, well, stop the train. Let's get a sample of this and look at it in more detail.
Meanwhile, scientists are drilling into the lower parts of the Earth's crust, several kilometers down, to see if there are forms of life there, living in ways much different than what we know as life on the surface. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
People call me the father of Shewanella.
Emojis, those little smiley faces and other symbols adding emotion and flair to the world's text messages, are about to get more diverse. Tech giant Apple is set to release a new set of the animated icons in varying skin tones. Currently, the only option is pale skin faces. The emojis depicting couples, families, and even characters like Santa Claus will also come in racially diverse options. And that's it for this edition of International Edition. Follow us 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
This is Today in History. On February 25th, 1570, Pope Pius V excommunicated Queen Elizabeth I of England. The Queen had sided with the Reformed movement against the Roman Catholic Church and had become head of the rival Church of England. Famed French painter Pierre-Auguste Renoir was born on this day in 1841. Along with Claude Monet, Renoir was a leader in the development of the Impressionist style. In 1870, Hiram Rhodes Revels, a Republican from Natchez, Mississippi, was sworn into the U.S. Senate, becoming the first black American to sit in Congress. In 1901, American financier J.P. Morgan incorporated the United States Steel Corporation. U.S. Steel was at one time the largest steel company in the world. In 1932, Austrian immigrant Adolf Hitler became a citizen of Germany. On this day in 1948, Czechoslovak President Eduard Beneš was forced to accept a Soviet-backed communist government following a bloodless coup that ended a brief effort to restore the country's pre-war democracy. In 1956, Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev, in a sensational speech to the 20th Congress of the Communist Party, denounced the personality cult of the late dictator Joseph Stalin. In 1986, Corazon Aquino was sworn in as the new Philippines president. In 2009, in Dhaka, Bangladesh, paramilitary soldiers staged a rebellion, leaving 74 people dead. In November 2013, more than 300 of the mutineers were sentenced to death or life in prison for their part in the revolt. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A core principle of United States foreign policy is the promotion of freedom of expression. After consultations with multiple stakeholders, the Departments of Treasury and Commerce have lifted the restriction on the export of some personal telecommunications devices to Sudan, such as smartphones and computers, to help give the Sudanese greater access to communication tools and better communicate amongst themselves and the world. These changes also support our aim to help Sudanese citizens integrate in the global digital community. The recent decision of the Sudanese government to stifle the press by seizing the full print run of 15 different newspapers made it clear that the Sudanese people need more freedom to access information. This seizure further highlights the importance of this licensing change because it facilitates the ability of the Sudanese to communicate with each other and with the outside world, which is an increasingly necessary step to alleviating poverty. Before this change, U.S. companies that wanted to export these goods, software, or services to Sudan had to seek a specific license from an office in the Treasury Department and authorization from the Department of Commerce. Now, this is no longer required for hardware, software, or related services. Banks, companies, and private citizens will now know that the export and re-export of these items is now permissible under U.S. law. The United States remains a committed partner to the people of Sudan, and as was the case with previous general licenses which authorized the exportation of agricultural commodities and equipment, food, medicine, and medical supplies, and certain academic and professional exchanges, this week's announcement reaffirms that commitment. We have a long history of direct people-to-people exchanges between our citizens, and as the 2013 Academic and Professional General License facilitated cultural, academic, and professional exchanges, which allowed more of us to meet face-to-face, this new general license will promote greater communication among our people and the global community. These changes will give Sudanese students, entrepreneurs, business people, journalists, civic leaders, and others better access to the telecommunications tools they need to study, create, and grow, and serve their communities.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.